On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Science, fellow members of the motion picture industry, and honored guests. This is one of the happiest moments of my life, and I want to thank each one of you who had a part in selecting me for one of the awards. For your kindness, it has made me feel very, very humble, and I shall always hold it as a beacon for anything that I may be able to do in the future. I sincerely hope I shall always be a credit to my race and to the motion picture industry. My heart is too full to tell you just how I feel. And may I say thank you, and God bless you.
Actress Hattie McDaniel accepting the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress in 1940. She won the award for her role in Gone with the Wind as Mammy. McDaniel was the first African-American to win an Oscar. Well, today, of course, we got the nominations for this year's Oscar Awards, and not a single person of color was nominated in an acting category. In a few minutes, what Hollywood can actually do to fix its diversity problem. But first, let's get the nominations themselves out of the way, the surprises, the snubs, and The Revenant. Joining me now to talk about it is Josh Dickey, entertainment editor and chief film writer for Mashable. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Madeline. Good morning.
Well, good to talk to you. Revenant has 12 nominations. Are you surprised there was such a sweep?
I am not anymore. I you know, when it took Best Drama at the Golden Globes, it felt very much like a turning point for that film, which was kind of trailing Spotlight in the conversation for Best Picture Oscar. But with all these nominations, And presuming it's going to pick up some trophies and the Guild Awards coming up in the coming weeks, I think it's definitely your front runner in a group that actually, almost to a movie, has a pretty good chance of upsetting it.
Really? So let's go through that. There's The Big Short, Bridge of Spies, Brooklyn, Mad Max, The Martian, Room, and Spotlight. You think all of those could win?
I pick about five of them to be actually really very likely, which is super unusual, at least for this time of year. You know, usually this is the time when we kind of get it down to a two-horse race. If I was forced to pick that two-horse race, I'd say it was The Revenant and Spotlight, kind of one and two. But I can't look at any of these movies and completely throw them off the boat. It's like even Bridge of Spies, which I think is probably the biggest surprise here. You know, you never know with Spielberg and with the Academy's finicky ways and with the preferential ballot going through its Byzantine system of figuring out the winner. I honestly believe that any one of these eight movies could win Best Picture.
Let's talk about snubs. Any surprise that Star Wars didn't get any of the big nominations?
I'm not real surprised. It picked up a bunch of, you know, kind of nifty technical ones that it deserves. By the way, that that franchise just hit 30 nominations. It's more tied with Lord of the Rings for total nominations by any franchise. So it's doing fine. I didn't think it was a Best Picture contender. I am surprised that Straight Outta Compton didn't make it into this group because it was getting a lot of love from the guilds. It's a great movie. It's a very polished movie. It's a very exciting movie.
We gave the people a voice. We gave the people truth.
Yeah, but your songs, they glamorize the lifestyle of gangs, guns, drugs.
Our art is a reflection of our reality. What you see when you go outside your door?
I know what I see.
And it ain't glamorous.
It feels like it belongs there. There's really two holes here that I see. There's Carol, which is much loved by many critics and was nominated for just about everything else it could have been, except for director. Mm-hmm. And Straight Outta Compton. I think those two films got shorted.
Carol, of course, the lead, Cate Blanchett, is nominated.
As is her co-star Rooney Mara for supporting, yeah.
Yeah. And also Creed not nominated, although Sylvester Stallone got a nomination.
You know, I think Creed probably could have easily picked up a director nomination, at least some, you know, an editing or some other nominations besides Stallone. But I guess if it was only going to be one, that was probably going to be the one.
And let's talk about Ex Machina. That movie got so much praise and, you know, great acting on the part of Alicia Vikander and, of course, Oscar Isaac, and not nominated.
That has, I think, something to do with the fact that the distributor behind it is A24, and they're wonderful. They're terrific marketers. They do more with less than anybody out there right now, as far as I'm concerned. But they really only had the resources to back one film. But you know, Alicia Vikander not making that nomination, for my money, I feel like the Academy picked the right spot for her, which was The Danish Girl. They picked out a performance there that showed us that Alicia is a true movie star, a Kate Winslet level movie star. Ex Machina, she was super cool in that. She was great. But, you know, again, if they were going to really put the resources behind something, I think with her, that was the right way to go.
I need my husband. Can you get him?
I can't.
I need to talk to my husband. I need to hold my husband. I need him. Can't you just get him? Can you at least try?
I'm sorry.
That, of course, was Alicia Vikander in The Danish Girl, and she's nominated for Best Supporting Actress for that role. But back to A24, what's the film that they ended up pushing this year?
That would be Room, which, you know, I mean, there's a good bet. It's nominated for a couple of major categories, Best Picture and Best Actress for Brie Larson.
And also Ridley Scott, The Martian, nominated, but he was not nominated. That seems strange.
This is an annual puzzle. It never makes sense. There's always one person who's missing from or included in the directing slot. It's been going back now for a few years with Ben Affleck not getting nominated for Best Director with Argo, which goes on to win Best Picture. Last year, you saw Ava DuVernay puzzlingly get left out of that group. I just think that the director's branch is so schizophrenic. There's something about them, I don't know if it's because of emotions, because of politics. It is a very cliquey group. That there's always either somebody who everybody assumes everybody else is voting for, so they don't, or maybe there's something we don't know about that person and their relationship with the director's branch that is being brought to bear here. But it's always something weird. Ridley just gets to take that spot this year.
I got to figure out a way to grow 3 years' worth of food here on a planet where nothing grows. Luckily, I'm a botanist. Mars will come to fear my botany powers.
All right, and finally, let's look at the documentaries. One documentary that was super popular, at least here in Los Angeles, Going Clear, the Scientology movie, not nominated.
Hollywood knows Scientology pretty well. I think we've got that narrative pretty much figured out. The movie didn't stray too far from the book or give us any real sort of scoop. So that might have been part of the reason that it was excluded. And this is a really fine group of documentaries, by the way. It's not like there's something in here that doesn't deserve to be.
Right. So you have Amy, Cartel Lamb, The Look of Silence, What Happened, Miss Simone, and Winter on Fire, Ukraine's Fight for Freedom. Just looking at that, I would assume that Amy is the favorite going into that.
I think so. There are a lot of people who really like Cartel Land, which I have not yet seen, by the way, in disclosure. But I think Amy runs away with this one.
Okay. Josh Dickey, Mashable's entertainment editor and chief film writer, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Madeline. Have a great day.
You too. And let's talk about another snub, a big one, People of Color. For the second year in a row, the Academy has only nominated white actors. The Oscars are a high-profile example of what's been dogging Hollywood for a long time now, the lack of diversity both on screen and behind the camera. So, how to change that? Darnell Hunt has studied diversity in Hollywood. He's director of the Ralph J. Bunche Center for African American Studies at UCLA. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you.
And Janet Yang is a film producer who produced The Joy Luck Club, among other films. She's also a member of the Academy. Welcome to you.
Thank you, Madeline.
So, Janet, the hashtag OscarsSoWhite was created last year, and now it's back. Is Hollywood tone deaf? Does it just love a sequel? What's happening?
Hollywood, it's a reflection of the whole industry, I fear. It's usually an exception to the rule when there is a black film that's nominated or any film with minorities. Last year we had a film, Selma. This year there were three good contenders, none of which were nominated. It's a sad reality that we've grown used to, unfortunately.
And Darnell, you oversaw a big study recently on diversity in Hollywood.
Sure.
Where are the biggest problems?
Well, the problem's everywhere. If you start with the academy, we're talking about an academy that membership 93% white, 76% male, average age 63, which is a particular set of sensibilities, a set of experiences, a sense of what constitutes artistic merit, quality. It's a very narrow set of criteria that tend to, over time, reproduce what we saw today, a lack of recognition of projects that don't fit that mold. Unfortunately, that's kind of where we are.
And Janet, you're a member of the Academy.
Yes, I am, since for almost 15 years now.
Yeah. Was there a film that you thought should have been nominated for Best Picture that wasn't?
Personally, I thought Straight Outta Compton should have had a good shot.
Uh-huh.
I thought it was a very, very well-made film, as was Concussion, as was Beasts of No Nation. But for my vote, I probably would have liked to most see Straight Outta Compton in that category.
Where are the Latino characters and the Asian characters?
They're not there, unfortunately. I think one thing that is changing the landscape and certainly changing the attitude of people at the studios and the finances is China's rise, of course. So there has been a lot of activity. It may not be apparent to most people, but it is certainly apparent to someone like myself and others who have been in that arena. There is definitely a very concerted effort to now reach that market in a big way. And that's, for me, the good news in all of this. As far as the Latin community, I am surprised and saddened because, again, as Darnella was saying, there is absolute evidence that that community goes to see movies in droves, you know, larger than the white population. So it's not logical. It's not rational. Yeah. I think it's more just a force of habit. There are the people who make the decisions, for the most part, just are in a comfort zone, and they're going to have to step out of the comfort zone.
And Darnell, what is the possible solution here, or what are some of the possible solutions? Does it come down to money and who is providing the money?
Well, in the end, it's about money. And one of the things that our study has tried to show over the last few years, and we have another edition of the study coming out in a few weeks, February 24th, we found a relationship between diversity and the bottom line. That is to say, films that roughly reflect the American population, on average, have the highest box office, which, you know, came as a revelation to people in the industry, mm-hmm. which it really shouldn't have, because people want to see their stories on the screen. They want to be able to relate to characters and so forth. And if we have an increasingly diverse population, which is right now almost 39% minority and only increasing, then that's going to be reflected in the box office. So I think that's going to have an impact. It's slow, and to the degree that it's having an impact now, we see it in casting. We haven't seen any impact at all behind the scenes in terms of writing and directing, producing, that type of thing. Those areas are completely, you know, with a few exceptions, we don't see people of color, and we see very few women. So, you know, those things are going to have to change, and we're going to have to diversify the executive suites, the people who are making decisions about what gets to be greenlit with what type of budget and so forth. I mean, all of those things are going to have to change.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned writing. Straight Outta Compton was nominated for original screenplay, but the writers are white.
Yeah.
So, Janet, do you think that TV has leaped ahead of film when it comes to this?
Absolutely. I think TV has. It's been there's so much more to cheer for on television, and I think the film industry just moves a little more slowly.
And Darnell, there are plenty of very wealthy minority people in the world who could be financing films,
sure.
or even running, you know, movie houses. So where are they in this conversation?
Well, I mean, everything is relative. When you say plenty, I mean, compared to the Hollywood, you know, system, we're talking about a relatively small group of people. And there are examples. Selma was a film, for example. The Butler were films that involved heavy engagement with African-American financiers. So there are examples. There are successful examples. But again, those are exceptions to the rule. And Hollywood as an industry is just not as open as it should be, particularly when we see that, you know, frequent moviegoers buy more than half of all tickets, and more than half of all frequent moviegoers are people of color. You know, so at some point, you know, the numbers just don't make sense to continue to do things the way that they're doing them now.
Right. And so when you have movies that are successful like Furious 7 and Straight Outta Compton, and those aren't really acknowledged at the Oscars, I mean, what does that tell you about the Oscars and how relevant they are in the larger movie business?
Well, it's a club, you know, and it's a club that's very exclusive, and with a few exceptions, but for the most part, we're talking about white men that run things and decide what is high quality, what's valued. And the problem for me is that it sets a tone in terms of what types of projects are high status projects, you know, what studios who want to be associated with Academy Awards think about when they're thinking about these signature projects. And it means that everything else is below the bar, and, you know, we'll make it for, you know, with a small budget, and we'll you know, reap the profits, but not really plow into it the types of resources that would lead to something bigger. So it kind of sets this, sets up this two-tiered system where you have women and minorities, you know, involved with smaller projects in terms of the budgets, and then these other projects that resemble more, I guess, what the Academy has in mind in terms of quality filmmaking that's made with larger budgets. And that's doing a disservice, really, to the market that wants to have access to diverse stories that resonate with their experiences.
Janet, I'm wondering, when you want to get a movie made, and let's say it's a movie with a non-white cast or a non-white story, what have you, how do you go about persuading the studios to go ahead with it?
Well, interestingly enough, times have really changed. People have asked me many times, why is there not another movie like Joy Luck Club? And that's because the economics of the industry have changed tremendously. So that film was possible then. It was possible to get a studio behind it and to give it its full marketing, you know, oomph. These days, that would not be possible. A movie like that just would not get made through the studio system.
Because it's too small?
It was the budget too small. It had an all minority cast, no big stars. It was a very unconventional movie in this narrative structure. So what I've been doing, and I'm glad I have this opportunity, is that I've been working primarily in China, because there's obviously a huge an abundance of resources there now, and a growing market and a real hunger to be in the game. So without that, I'm really not sure what I'd be doing if I wanted to focus on films with some minority content. It'd be very, very tough. Again, so many of the films that I've made in the past would not be made today. And that's because the whole sort of middle of stuff. You can make a very, very small indie movie, you know, and hopefully get to Sundance, or you go the studio route and make these gargantuan movies. But they've pretty much relinquished the middle ground.
Janet Yang, film producer and member of the Academy, Darnell Hunt, sociology professor and director of the Ralph J. Bunche Center for African American Studies at UCLA. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
And we'd love to hear from you. What do you think were the most overlooked movies or performances in today's Oscar nominations? You can leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or let us know on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, we continue our series on President Obama's unfinished business. Today, Afghanistan. We still have troops there. What are they doing, and what is the U.S. goal there? That's next on Press Play.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. President Obama is entering his last year in office, and all week we've been discussing the president's unfinished business. Today, Afghanistan. With U.S. forces being drawn down, the Taliban has been resurgent. The group holds more territory now than it has at any time since it was ousted from power back in 2001. And ISIS is also gaining a foothold in the country. Yesterday, 7 people were killed in an ISIS attack in the city of Jalalabad. The U.S. has come to the conclusion that Afghan forces are really not ready to hold the country against insurgents, and so that means American troops will remain. President Obama announced last October that the U.S. would maintain between 5 and 10,000 troops in Afghanistan through the end of his time in office.
As Commander-in-Chief, I will not allow Afghanistan to be used as safe haven for terrorists to attack our nation again. Our forces therefore remain engaged in two narrow but critical missions: training Afghan forces and supporting counterterrorism operations against the remnants of Al-Qaeda.
Christine Fair is assistant professor at Georgetown University Center for Peace and Security Studies. She was also a political officer to the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me again.
Great to have you. So according to reports, the Taliban now controls or has a significant presence in almost a third of Afghanistan. So how tenuous is the government's hold now, considering these advances on the part of the Taliban?
Well, actually, the government's hold has always been tenuous in Afghanistan. I think one of the biggest problems that we have had from the beginning is that we've never had a Pakistan plan. The reason why we're in this predicament is because Pakistan, a partner that we've paid now some $33 billion to allegedly assist us in these efforts, has been undermining them from the get-go. The Pakistanis provide military assistance. They provide sanctuary. It's absolutely impossible to defeat the Taliban when they have these sanctuaries in Pakistan. And the Pakistanis have been absolutely adamant in maintaining the support. And so from my point of view, what we could not have achieved with 140,000, which was the maximum number of troops that we had following the surge, we're certainly not going to be able to achieve it with 10,000. And so whether we have 140 or 10,000, our fundamental problem really remains actually located in the country that we're not occupying, which is actually Pakistan.
Yeah, and so that's more of a diplomatic problem than a military problem.
Yes and no. Most of the assistance that we've given the Pakistanis have been military. Mm-hmm. We have given them access to strategic systems, for example, F-16s. We've given them this equipment ostensibly under the excuse that it will actually help them support counterterrorism and counterinsurgency operations, even though we know that this is absolutely risible. So the precise explanation for why it is that we continue to indulge a country that takes our money and kills our troops would probably take longer than you actually have for this show. But it is a combination of military and diplomatic reasons why we continue to coddle Pakistan, even though it primarily is responsible for the loss of life, both Afghan and non-Afghan, that we're experiencing.
So meanwhile, we have these 5,000 to 10,000 troops in Afghanistan, at least until the end of the year. You know, what are they going to be doing there, and how long do you see a U.S. presence?
Well, I mean, as the president said, I mean, they really have two functions, right? One is to basically, there were always two military functions in Afghanistan. One was what was called Operation Enduring Freedom, and that really was a counterterrorism mission. We were supposed to be operating against Al-Qaeda and affiliated groups. And then there was the effort that was really under NATO, ISAF, that was intended to build the Afghan government and to support it. And then this is, of course, transitioned under the security transition to Afghan responsibility. So in that second capacity, we're going to be continuing to do basically training and advising. So it's basically counterterrorism, which is always a line of activity that the Americans dominated, and then the support function.
So meanwhile, I believe we've spent, the U.S. has spent $110 billion on reconstruction.
Well, actually more than that. We've actually surpassed what we spent in the Marshall Plan.
Wow. And what do we have for that money?
It's a phenomenal number, like $1 trillion.
And what do we have in terms of, you know, institutions in Afghanistan for that money?
Actually, this is the problem. The U.S. government decided that it had to build the biggest government that ever existed in Afghanistan's history. And so at one point, we were looking at an Afghan National Security Force structure that was well in excess of 400,000. The problem with this is that the size of government that the U.S. government insisted upon building in Afghanistan is completely unsustainable financially. The government cannot pay even its recurring costs. So what we have done is that we have built the biggest government that has ever existed while completely ignoring what I think is perhaps the most important aspect of the Afghan transition, which is in the economic transition. When the United States no longer writes the checks to pay for this government, we are basically the only one writing those checks, the entire thing that we have built will collapse. The Afghan National Security Forces are essentially overlapping network of militias that have militia commanders, when they're no longer being paid to operate under the guise of the Afghan National Army, they're going to go back to their constituent parts, which was a bunch of militias. Everyone focuses upon the troops and the troop drawdown. There has been very little attention paid to the economic drawdown, and that is the real problem. Afghanistan has a lot of resources, but because of the insecurity, it can't get those resources out of the ground into the markets. It's had capital flight. It has virtually no ability, for all intents and purposes, to extract taxes from its population in any event, because of the capital flight, the tax base is in any event shrinking. So leave aside the security issues, which are very real. As long as Afghanistan can continue paying its national security forces, it can probably hold on to what we're calling a stalemate. The goal, actually, of the current administration's plans in Afghanistan are not to decisively defeat the Taliban, but rather to allow the Afghan national security forces to keep what we're calling a stalemate. So as long as those checks can be written, it's likely that goal can hold. But we're not going to be paying those checks in perpetuity.
Yeah. Well, and then meanwhile, the Taliban is in disarray without a strong leader to hold it together. ISIS is making inroads. So could there also be like all-out, full-fledged civil war in that country?
Yeah, and you know, I think the probability of that actually increases with every passing month. When Mullah Omar was there, or at least people had the illusion that Mullah Omar was there, the Pakistanis basically kept that fiction alive in hopes that they could get some sort of a settlement which would put Taliban into leadership positions at the national and subnational level without them having to contest elections. The Afghan intelligence actually leaked the truth that Mullah Omar had in fact been dead, and that his designated successor had been part of the fiction that he was still alive. As long as Mullah Omar was believed to have been alive, allied groups, like, for example, like the Pakistani Taliban, remained loyal to him, with some important exceptions. When the truth came out that he was a part of this ruse, many of those allied militant groups simply defected to ISIS. Taliban commanders were also defecting to ISIS, in part because they were pretty frustrated with Taliban being on Pakistan's leash. And it gave them an opportunity to continue engaging in violence and resource extraction, but under a different banner. It's not really clear how close they are, for example, to ISIS leadership, al-Baghdadi, but they are branding themselves as ISIS. And they are engaging in brutality that even make the Taliban look reasonable.
Christine Fair, assistant professor at Georgetown University Center for Peace and Security Studies. Thank you for that depressing and sobering update.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Coming up, continuing with the president's unfinished business, Gitmo, the prison the president vowed to close 8 years ago, is still open. Part of the problem? We've never dealt with anything like this before.
It's kind of, honestly, make it up as you go along. I mean, really, they are writing the laws. They are setting the precedents as they're going.
Can the president make good on one of his first promises, closing Guantanamo Bay? That's next, after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Pentagon today announced that it would transfer 10 detainees out of Guantanamo Bay. The detainees are from Yemen, but they'll be transferred to Oman. Despite campaign promises dating back to 2008, President Obama has been unable to close the prison at Guantanamo. Here's what President Obama said earlier this week at his State of the Union address.
I will keep working to shut down the prison at Guantanamo. It is expensive, it is unnecessary, and it only serves as a recruitment brochure for our enemies. There's a better way.
But getting to that better way has been a long slog. At the height of the war on terror, Guantanamo held nearly 800 prisoners. After today's news, that number will stand at 93. Journalist Janet Reitman recently visited Guantanamo. She's a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine, and her story in the most recent issue is Inside Gitmo, America's Shame. When I spoke to her earlier, I began by asking her just how difficult it is to get to Guantanamo in the first place.
It is really difficult, and it depends on what you're going for. If you're going to attend one of the military commission hearings, those are open proceedings, and they're open to the press, and so you can go. You have to sign a 13-page media guidelines document, which is, I will just say from my own experience of signing these guidelines in other situations where I'm with the U.S. military, this is the longest document I've ever signed. By many pages, actually. Mm-hmm. And they sort of go through this long vetting period of you. It can take as little as a few days, or it could take, allegedly, 45 days. And then you get on a plane that's chartered by the Pentagon, and you fly down. And, you know, once you're there, you're kind of in their care. Mm. The other way you do
it is like embedded, as if you're...
Yes, it's an embed in a fake war zone.
Yeah.
In a fake... Gitmo, I should just explain, is a naval station, and it's just like any other base, mm-hmm. you know, like it's like suburbia, okay? Like all naval bases, all military bases are like suburbia. So you show up when you're doing the military commissions, and you arrive there on this little airstrip. You have to take a ferry across the bay, and that's where the base really is, and that's where the prison, and that's where the legal facility, the legal complex is. You drive down this little road, and then you sort of drive down this, like, dusty hill through these checkpoints. And you arrive in this place that, for, I swear to God, for anyone who has ever, you know, even been in any kind of a war zone or seen a war movie, looks like a forward operating base in, like, Kandahar. But it's not. It's in the Caribbean. It has tents.
But why? You know? Because all of the detainees slash prisoners are... behind bars, and behind very well fortified bars. Right? I mean, what's the threat?
I don't think there really is one. I think the military will tell you this is a high security facility. We have people who have, you know, this is the worst of the worst. You know, we are especially in the camp. This place is called Camp Justice, and Camp Justice is there specifically for, at the moment, really, really for five people, the 9/11 five, the people they could not try here in New York City, where I'm talking to you from. So this Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his four alleged co-conspirators of the 9/11 plot. And, you know, these people who have been there for years and before that were in CIA custody are considered, you know, so dangerous and lethal. At one point, they were described, all the Guantanamo prisoners were described as being able to, like, chew through hydraulics cables or something like that. And, you know, like, they would do anything. And, you know, and so, you know, they are the devil personified. And we must have a super fortified legal complex that you have to go through, like, 16, you know, checkpoints and not bring anything in there. And, you know, except for your notebook and a pen, no recording device, no phone, you know, nothing like that. And you know, be vetted in every possible way. And then, you know, you can't even sit in the courtroom. You sit behind triple thick glass, watching the proceedings.
And these proceedings
it's really all a show.
What's happening there?
Well, I mean, what's happening there is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the 9/11 case, is moving towards trial at a snail's pace. I mean, it's in pretrial hearings, motions. It's been like that for 4 years now. Basically, every single aspect of the military commissions is being litigated by the lawyers for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his co-defendants, because they're in a capital case. They could be put to death. So they have these wonderful attorneys, you know, capital defense attorneys, who are making sure that every possible little tiny element is challenged. Also because the military commission system is not like a federal court, and nor is it like a military court. It's kind of its own thing. And it's kind of, honestly, make it up as you go along. I mean, really. I mean, they are writing the laws. They are setting the precedents as they're going.
So this is costing, what, millions?
Oh, my God.
And millions?
Millions. Millions. We were asking how much it actually costs. It wouldn't tell us.
And then you could go and check out the prison itself and see the other detainees?
No, to do that requires an entirely different trip. If you want to visit the prison, you have to go through a different office. You go through the military's office in Guantanamo, not the Pentagon. Even if you've just attended a hearing, you have to fly back to D.C., right, which is what I did, and then like a week later, fly down to Florida to Fort Lauderdale, aboard a tiny little shuttle for this flight to Gitmo, which is going to take you to the exact same place. You're going to be met up with the exact same public affairs minders.
So what is their reasoning for that? Why the two separate systems? Why all the bureaucracy?
I have no idea.
There's no reason. It just is.
What I have found at Gitmo in my, like, you know, two trips down there is that this system has been set up to strategically keep you in the dark. There is a very strategic, willful ignorance that just pervades the place. You know, this is a place that is now, as of January, entering into now its 15th year. We're 14 years past, right? Terrible things have happened to Guantanamo. Terrible things have happened to some of the people who are at Guantanamo who came from CIA custody. We know this because of the torture report. You know, at minimum, there are people there who have not been charged with a crime and are in prison. And you can't, you have all kinds of questions for people about why. And nobody can answer that. And that's because they are there for 9-month deployments. They're National Guard's troops. And it's like a strategy so that they don't have to answer the hard questions, so that they literally cannot answer the hard questions, and they have to stick to a script, which is the only thing they know. It becomes really challenging to them when they are confronted by journalists who know something, and they've now restricted access dramatically. Mm. And part of that, actually, I must confess, is because the trip that I was on, myself and another journalist were very belligerent with some of the soldiers that were giving us this tour. We were just asking them some really hard questions, and they did not like that we were pushing them on various points. Mm. So they used this as a reason to cut off a lot of access for the media, and it's hugely unfair to the public.
That also affects the detainees in a way, the ones that have been cleared for release many, many years ago, some of them, and yet they are not going to be released because why?
Well, the Obama administration has said that they are going to try to transfer out 17 people who have been cleared and actually... But, you know, most of these people were cleared either early in the Obama administration or in the Bush administration. And then the Defense Department, however, is the ultimate sort of signer off. They have to make sure that all the security conditions for this person's transfer are in place. They are basically the last word, essentially. And there has been, according to, you know, the people I've spoken to, and there's also been some reporting on this recently, that there's just an incredible amount of obstruction within the Defense Department going back many, many years, you know, where apparently there are people within the DOD who don't want to transfer Gitmo people out of Gitmo. They think they should be there. And they'll just delay and delay until all of a sudden the transfer that people at state have like painstakingly put together. They've done negotiations. They've had diplomatic meetings. They've traveled to like some far-flung country where they're going to transfer this person. You know, that deal begins to then sort of disintegrate.
But can't the Defense Secretary Ashton Carter, can't he just say, look, these people need to get out of there. They're cleared. Let's find a place for them and cut through the red tape?
Well, that's what Obama should be saying, and I think that's what he has been saying. And I think that Ash Carter more recently has been moving on this. This is the big, you know, issue that a lot of, you know, sort of civil rights attorneys, human rights attorneys will point to as, you know, what President Obama could do if he wants to close Guantanamo would be to put tremendous pressure on the Defense Department to say, look, you know, make sure your underlings move. I do not believe that Secretary of Defense Hagel was willing to do this, which is one of the reasons that he did not last very long. There's also this other category, however, of prisoner. So you have these guys that are cleared. They were told years ago they've been found completely not guilty of any terrorist-related activity. They should not have been there in many cases to begin with. Then there's another class called who we've called them the forever prisoners, okay? These are people who will never be charged with a crime, will never be tried in any regard, but they have been dubbed too dangerous to let go and also untriable. So those are the people that would have to come to the United States if we were to close Gitmo. And if in the very bizarre off chance that someone who goes on trial is actually acquitted, you know, like say one of KSM's colleagues, they will never go free. So they're there forever. It's a really dark reality, and it permeates that place. There's a sort of a sick feeling you have when you're there, and it's hard to put your finger on exactly what it is, but it's just something deeply wrong about it.
That's Janet Reitman. She's a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine. The latest issue has her article. It's called Inside Gitmo, America's Shame. And Warren Olney is here now.
Hello.
To tell us what's happening at 1 o'clock. Hello there.
Nice to see you. What's happening at 1 o'clock is we're going to take a look at what's going on in Europe as a result of the cultural changes that are taking place there, not just because of the refugees that are coming now, but because of refugees that have already been there for some time, including particularly the Turkish refugees or migrants who have been in Germany for a long time, sometimes for more than one generation, but who still identify themselves as in a different culture. And now that's really being exaggerated by the influx of all the refugees from North Africa and from the Middle East. And we've gotten to the point where, as a result in part of demonstrations, not demonstrations, but a terrible event that took place in Cologne in Germany on New Year's Eve, where a large number of people, many of them identified as refugees, began groping women, subjecting them to sexual abuse. And just to make a long story short, this is a threat to the open borders of the European Union.
Schengen Agreement.
Yes, yeah. And that's beginning to be eroded very seriously.
Wow, which could unravel the entire thing?
Huge economic consequences if you can't get back and forth across the border, if your truck has to sit there, grinding away, waiting for the border agent to
let you through. I mean, it's a central tenet of the EU.
Sure, of course.
Well,
one of the great achievements of the European Union after hundreds of years of battling between those countries.
Interesting. All right, 1 o'clock, to the point, Warren Olney, be there. Coming up on this program, Shani Jardin is here for our weekly web roundup. Today, we're going to talk about a lawsuit against Twitter alleging that it enables ISIS. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcast you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Time again when Shani Jardin joins us to elucidate us about all things web.
Well, hello. Let me just step out of my spaceship gif here and into the real world.
Well, we did use the word elucidate.
It's a gif. All right. Before the hate mail arrives, it's a gif. Fine.
I wasn't going to even say anything about that as a choosy mother. Anyway. Moving on, there is a lawsuit brought by the family of a man who was killed in Jordan, and they are suing Twitter for enabling ISIS. This man was killed in an ISIS attack.
You know, when is Twitter not at the receiving end of a wacky lawsuit? This one is, it's not wacky funny. This involves a man who died in a terrorist attack, but the family, the surviving family, are suing Twitter, saying that Twitter basically knew about the fact that ISIS was using the social media platform as a recruitment and promotional tool and didn't do enough to stop that. That they ban people for violating their terms of service all the time, but somehow it's okay for ISIS to exist there. And I think this lawsuit, first of all, I don't think the surviving family has a very good chance of winning it. Mm. But secondly, I think this opens up a really interesting discussion about, are these entertainment platforms? Are they communication platforms? Do we allow any and all free speech to exist and sort of let the power of positive free speech and social awareness keep things in order? Or should some things or some people just not be able to access those platforms?
Well, especially when you consider ISIS in particular uses social media more than most other terrorist groups to spread its message, to recruit, to do all sorts of things.
It's a private platform, but they've used it as if it was their own. The lawsuit says, without Twitter, the explosive growth of ISIS over the last few years into the most feared terrorist group in the world would not have been possible. It's hard to argue with that. But if it wasn't Twitter, it would have been something else.
Right. But then on the other hand, you have a lot of women online complaining about Twitter's lack of cracking down on harassers.
Well, you know, I'm one of those women. I've experienced about as bad as it gets. I don't believe that it's Twitter's job to figure out who to silence. I do believe that with smarter architecture, people like me who are on the receiving end of abuse should be able to ignore that more easily. I don't care if those terrible people read what I say. I don't need to block them from hearing my voice, but I certainly don't want to get rape or death threats when I'm just logging on to Twitter to share, you know, a muffin recipe.
but it gets at the question of what responsibility Twitter has to police who's on it. And
yeah.
And to, you know, is this a free, is this like a billboard where people can just put up whatever they want, or does Twitter actually have some responsibility to manage that billboard?
I mean, let's get real. Look, the government files secret requests to companies like Twitter and Google and Facebook all the time looking for information on, for instance, activists associated with WikiLeaks or with anonymity tools like Tor. We know that national security letters are sent and, when possible, reported to the public, but sometimes that takes years. And if our nation's security and military chiefs wanted ISIS off Twitter, ISIS would be off Twitter. It's probably very useful intelligence for our military and for the people who make decisions to kind of see what they have to say. And yes, people who are stupid enough to think that that's an awesome club that they should want to go join might get turned on and buy a one-way ticket to wherever it is they train people. Everything that ISIS does is about amplifying that message of hate. Twitter's a very powerful amplification tool.
All right, let's move on to the national obsession, at least it was yesterday, Powerball.
Powerball!
Which is pretty low tech, all things considered, because the winners are determined by actually physically picking a ball with mm-hmm. numbers on that ball. And yet...
it's a ball of power.
And yet there was some hijinks online involving the Powerball.
When are there not? Look, whenever you dangle, what did it end up being, $1.5 billion in front of the internet is going to find ways to try to get at that sweet Powerball, but also to make fun of it. So yes, there were accounts impersonating official accounts, trying to trick people into parting with money or parting with likes. I think there was like a photoshopped Powerball ticket that ended up getting gajillions of likes on one platform or another. This was just all over the place, and there were a lot of kind of tepidly, lukewarmly funny Powerball memes. But the truth is, like ISIS, Powerball benefits from amplification on social media, and people bought their tickets. The funniest thing that we saw on Boing Boing, there was a Fox News analyst who was roundly criticized for this moment on Fox News that was screen captured and pasted all over social media, just saying, if you want to win the Powerball, buy as many tickets as you can afford. And we blogged that and said, well, yeah, you should also take out a payday loan at those usurious 200% interest rates, and then you could buy more Powerball tickets. So I didn't play. I guess I'm just bitter because I didn't win that sweet $1.5 billion.
All right. Another big story that is has come and gone, or at least the application has come and gone so fast. Peach.cool. What is that and what happened?
Peach is a new social media app that, as of noon Pacific time last Friday, no one knew about it. And then by like 4 or 5 p.m. LA time on Friday, all of the big usernames, all the celebrities, all the brands were taken. over the weekend, this new social network, which was launched by the creators of Vine, and to me felt a little bit like Tumblr meets Snapchat meets Instagram meets Vine minus Facebook plus a little soupçon of Twitter.
And a little bit of Powerball.
Oh, a little bit of Powerball. By the time the weekend was over, there were a lot of frustrated people. The app, in my opinion, wasn't QC'd properly. They didn't think about quality control. They didn't think about bugs as thoroughly as they might have. And they just weren't prepared for the load. So adding friends was tedious. The app crashed all the time. And there was a little, like a little mini tornado of think pieces, hot takes, as we call them in the industry, suggesting that Peach had been cobbled, you know, the beach crumbled.
Nice.
But now, you know, I'm looking at my Google News search this morning, and I'm seeing a lot of excited press in mainstream outlets, which tells me that your family members and their friends and the people at work and the aunties and the uncles, they're going to be trying this out. I don't think it's dead yet.
Oh, so it's not dead yet. Yeah. Well, remember Ello from a couple of years ago?
Yeah. So Ello was going to take on Facebook during a time when people were very frustrated about privacy issues with Facebook. Mm-hmm. Meerkat, remember the little live video streaming thing that went up against Periscope and Facebook's live video? Meerkat is an extinct species now.
Oh, not in real life, thankfully.
Not in real life. I think it's too early to predict whether Peach will be a flop or not. I'm really enjoying it. And you can find me at XENI, and you should follow Boing Boing as well, and you should see how we're experimenting with the medium. And that basically means we're posting a lot of goofy stuff.
there isn't enough of that.
I post little short videos of my dogs.
Oh, that's cute.
It doesn't get any better. It's quality content, people. A+.
All right. Shani Jordan, co-editor of BoingBoing.net. Thanks, Shani.
Thank you, Madeline.
Always a peach. Jolie Myers is here.
If you want dog pics and videos, holler at my Instagram.
Come to the right source here.
Meatloaf. It's like meatloaf and bottles of beer that I'm interested in.
Meatloaf is Joey's dog.
That's right. Meatloaf is my dog. Okay. Blah, blah, blah. We talked about the Oscars at the top of the show today. And the hashtag OscarsSoWhite made an appearance while our friend Lalo Alcaraz, who is now one of the writers on Border Town, was tweeting all about OscarsSoWhite. He says, Oscars so white, they interviewed El Chapo for Rolling Stone, one of my favorites. And second favorite, hashtag Oscars so white, they just took over an unoccupied federal bird sanctuary in Oregon. Ding!
Pretty good.
So our listeners had a lot to say about this, obviously, on Facebook. Lenny Bernal says, wait, we're surprised by this? Yeah, it's the whitest Oscars since last year. And as you pointed out, you know, Hollywood likes a sequel.
Yeah.
but Daphne Brooks actually did a little bit of a deeper dive in her comment, and she commented on the documentary category, saying that What Happened to Miss Simone, about a black singer, is being forgotten next to Amy, who is a soul singer who is white, soul music obviously being black. So there's an interesting tension in the documentary category.
Very interesting.
As well. Thank you, Daphne, for giving us that comment.
Both made by white filmmakers, by the way.
Correct.
Jolie Myers, thank you very much. And Warren Olney will be here in a few minutes from now, so stay right here on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a fantastic afternoon, and I will see you tomorrow.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.